Hey, welcome to the Chess Experience. On this show, it's all about helping adult improvers. I want to make learning chess easier for you to navigate, and I also want you to have a more fun experience along the way. I'm your host, Daniel Lona, a fellow chess amateur. Let's get to it. This show is sponsored by Chess.com, the world's largest chess community. Chess.com recently launched a new way to learn from your games with a feature called Insights. If you visit chess.com/insights, you can get detailed stats and analysis in any of the time controls you've played and across any time period. What kind of things can you learn? Well, you can learn what time of day do you play your best, morning, afternoon, or night? What part of the game are you strongest or weakest, opening, middle game, or end game? Are you making more or less mistakes than opponents at your level? You can find out all this great info and much more at chess.com/insights. Welcome to this week's show. Coming back to the podcast for a second time is Grandmaster Noel Studer. First, some quick background on Noel if you're not familiar with him. Noel is the youngest ever GM from Switzerland. He was also the Swiss chess champion in 2016 and 2019. In 2021, he retired from competitive chess and has since been creating chess improvement content with his weekly newsletter. A couple of years ago, Noel released his flagship course called Next Level Chess, which teaches you how to get the most out of your study and playing time. And now he has just released a course called Beginner Chess Mastery. And I have links to all that if you're interested in Noel's content in the show notes and on the episode page for this podcast on my website. So in this episode, we discuss all things related to chess improvement. In the first part of the episode, we discuss different ways you can make your chess improvement journey more fun and interesting. Then in the second half, we discuss some universal lessons Noel learned from creating his beginner course, as well as an interesting discussion on beginners in general. Now, I know many of you listening are beyond the beginner level, maybe way beyond, but I still think you'll find the beginner-related discussion we have in this interview engaging and worth your time. Why? Well, first, as chess fans, we're always eager to bring more folks into the game. And if you want to do that and help your friends or family members play, it helps to understand a little of their specific challenges as a beginner, such as what helps them and what doesn't. Plus, I think Noel's discussion of beginners and his course in general has some fascinating stuff in it. So without further delay, here's my interview with Noel. I hope you enjoy it. Hi, Noel. It's great to have you back on the podcast. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me, Daniel. I'm doing great.
That's fantastic. I'm glad to hear that. And I'm excited to dive into like a whole new set of topics and questions with you. Your interview that we did, your episode, I should say, that we did last time, I thought was great. And the audience thought so as well. It is one of the most downloaded podcasts episodes that I've had in the past year. So people definitely enjoyed your last interview that we had together. So I'm sure we can give them another very helpful and hopefully entertaining one too.
Yeah, nice to hear. Let's try.
Yeah, we'll do our best. So I guess kind of where I wanted to start, well, I don't think we had a chance to talk about this last time. It's just a little bit maybe in your own chess journey at where you are right now. I know you've been busy lately with creating and running online chess courses, or one up to this point, very soon to be two. And of course, you're doing your weekly newsletter. But in spite of that busyness, what does your personal chess practice look like these days?
It doesn't exist. So yeah, I've retired. Now we're getting close to 3 years of chess retirement. And I'm more of a all-in or nothing person. So I'm not playing anything, you know, on the side. Sometimes I play a little bit of online blitz, but usually that's more ending into frustration because I'm not really focused or whatever. So no, I don't aspire to improve my own chess. And I feel that to make the best work possible for my blog, for my students, I don't need to improve my own chess, but I need to improve how to teach. I need to improve, how to have an online business. I need to improve myself as a person, my energy level, but not my chess anymore.
Yeah, that makes total sense. You've already reached quite a high level as is. But that said, I'm just curious, like, I know you said you play a little bit of online blitz here or there. Do you do anything just maybe kind of not from an improvement perspective, but just recreationally, like, oh, you know what, I'll just you know, get out my board and go through this annotated game book just to see some games and just kind of for the experience of it as opposed to improvement. I imagine there's not much time for that anyhow, even if you wanted to, but I'm curious if you do anything like that.
Not really. So, I mean, my fiance is also playing and working in chess, right? So sometimes we'll play a game against Alessia. But yeah, it's more like discussing general news in chess and some online chess stuff and maybe looking at actually some YouTubers, for example, like what are they doing? How are they coming up with ideas? I'm more interested in this kind of stuff at the moment. And then obviously I have a lot of friends in the chess world that still play actively. So sure. Especially if they have an important tournament going on, I'll check in from time to time. But I'm also not on top of the things. Like, if you ask me what happened in the last super tournament, that's a tough question. Like, I barely know the results.
Right. Well, those are a couple of you know, like maybe smaller chess activities, I guess you could say, that I was kind of curious about that you're doing. So that's still cool that it's kind of there in that way for you. And never mind the fact that you're thinking about chess 8 to 10 hours a day, right, with your courses and helping people. So there's that too. Speaking of which, you know, I subscribed to your newsletter. I believe it was your most recent one that you had put out was on a subject that I actually am very interested in, because I think it's very relevant for adult club players. You know, there's this part of them that wants to work hard and improve. And, you know, they do want to put in energy and time towards that. But I think there's also this other part of them where there's some chess activities they could do that are less helpful from an improvement perspective, but are nonetheless just fun to engage with because we love chess. For example, you know, watching, as you kind of referenced a little bit, watching maybe a chess content creator's video on YouTube. Sometimes those can just be more pure entertainment. Other times they can be a little, you know, very educational oriented, but, you know, just whatever, something along those lines. And I think it's a tough balance for adult improvers. In your newsletter, you made the point that doing only what's fun in chess will probably not lead to the satisfaction somebody wants. But you also at least seem to acknowledge in the newsletter that trying to insert some measure of fun into the process is worthwhile, is worth thinking about and trying to do. So I was wondering if you could just kind of address that, that tug of war that we have, and maybe how do we balance that?
Yeah, so when I talked about this in my course, Next Level Training, the one that I've released already a while back, I was always very clear about, you know, people being aware what they are doing and what it is for. So I like to have a clear idea of, like, am I sitting down and I'm trying to get better, or am I sitting down and I try to have fun? So I still try to, you know, kind of separate. If the activity is, you know, it's meant to be fun, so you're doing something you know that is more fun, then just be aware that it is more fun and you're not really taking away a lot. And when you try to sit down and get better, then really try to take something where you really get better. And the idea in the newsletter was also you can actually make that activity more fun as well. So you can do something that makes you stronger and might be hard, and you can try to make it more interesting, more fun. So I really like that idea, and I got it from a YouTuber actually who wrote a book, which is called Feel Good Productivity. And the whole idea was to understand what makes you better or what makes you learn. For example, he takes the idea from learning for medicine. He was a doctor. And then making that activity fun. So you start from a point of, I want to get better, I want to learn. And then you find ways to make that thing that might be a little bit dry or not so fun, to try it more fun. And I really, really loved that idea.
Yeah, that is a fantastic idea. And I love taking one step prior to that, the distinction that you made between just being aware and intentional of what you're going to do right now, and you know, acknowledging whether it's something that's part of, say, your improvement program versus just something you wanted to do in chess just for the fun of it, just because you like chess. I think that's a great starting point. I appreciate that. And the idea that you presented just a moment ago as well about working to make the process more enjoyable, more maybe even more fun is a great one too. And in that newsletter, you had a couple, you had several strategies, more than a couple, for how to do that. I was wondering if you could just maybe dive into a little bit of that and offer up a couple of examples of strategies you suggested to make the chess learning process more fun.
Yeah, sure. I thought I want to just give a clear image of like that distinction of the or the self-awareness needed. I think it's super important, like the self-awareness in chess training, like for everybody listening, that's basically, I would say, nearly the number one skill if you want to improve anything. Like if you're not completely aware of what you want, what your goals are and what your actions actually are driving towards, you will fail if you're not self-aware. So that's like, I think that's one of my biggest, you know, strength, that I can just look in the mirror and say, okay, you know, I don't want to improve this, so that's fine. Or I want to improve this, but I'm not pushing towards that. So that is like a very underrated thing, I would say, that many people miss, because I think sometimes what people want of me is they want that I tell them that the fun stuff will also make them improve. But I'm not providing that, you know? That's usually, if somebody tells you that, usually they want your money and they offer something that isn't as great. They're saying like, yeah, you can just, you know, just play 5 hours of bullet and you'll get better. It's like, yeah, you know, it's like, where's the right catch? So yeah. Just wanted to take some more time on that. And then on the making training fun. So what you can do is you can track your training. That's something I like to do. I like to do with many things. I'm rather competitive, so I like to track the stuff I do and then to be able to compare myself. So now that I'm not doing much chess training anymore, or no chess training anymore, I use it in gym, for example. So I can track how much weight did I use, and I can try to, you know, increase the weight, and it just feels so good. I just yesterday had a gym session where I was able to squat 5 kilograms more. That would be, I think, 10 pounds. Nice. So that's quite nice. My legs really, really hurt. But it's just something I can say, oh yeah, that's actually nice. Like that's, I did some stuff and it really works. You can see the results better, and that in turn makes it also fun. Something else you can use is to socialize it. So you can try to, you know, train with your friends. And many people say, well, I don't have access to a chess club nearby. So you can try to, you know, join online chess communities, and then you can try to just jump on a Discord call and just decide which book you work with, for example. And you try to work with the same book if you're in more or less the same rating. And then you say 45 minutes, we'll solve some stuff. And then 15 minutes, we talk about what we solved, right? And you don't even talk in these 45 minutes, but you know somebody else is on the other side of this call. So if I'm not doing this, you also get some accountability from that. But it can also be fun, and you can, you know, say, oh, that was so annoying. But still, there is somebody doing this with you. That could be an idea as well.
Yeah, that's a great one. I actually really love that part about socializing the experience. I think that makes a night and day difference, both just in terms of your own overall enjoyment of the process itself, and to the heart of what your goal is, which is to improve. I just think when you're part of a community, regardless of how large it is, whether you're part of an online community that's thousands of people, or you just have maybe one friend that you connect with in chess, in person or like through Zoom calls or something, whatever, that you can just kind of join in this process with, that it just changes everything. I think we're just kind of social beings anyhow. And so when we try to do something completely isolated, I feel like we're missing out on a lot. So yeah, I really love that part. I think people forget that that's a key way to do it. And I also just want to add one other thing and get your opinion on it, on socializing it, Noel, which is, we're kind of speaking about intentionality here, right? And I love that point that you made about that earlier. And I think that applies here too. Like, you know, maybe people just post a little bit online or something like that, and that's great, but that's not necessarily being very proactive about how you want to socialize your improvement process. So I think like if you kind of sat down and thought about it for a few minutes about ways that you could do that, you probably get a lot more out of it. But your opinion on that?
Yeah, definitely. There are ways and ways, right? We see a lot of, you know, the nice communities also on Twitter, but I'm just not a big fan of Twitter, for example, because you get the good and the bad, right? You just are exposed to a, you know, algorithm and the thread or whatever, and maybe comparison with people that you don't want to compare with and so on. So the more curated it is, the better in general. So
right.
A fun thing I see inside my Discord server from Next Level Training, the course I have, is that people aren't as active, but it's actually a good and a bad thing, right? You would, in a way, it would be good that, like, people are talking together and so on. But at the end of the day, you don't get better by talking to others, but you get better by doing the work. So actually many people enter the community and they are very talkative. And then you just realize, well, they just do their training. And I'm very happy for them in a way, right? So it's like a community can be good when people talk to each other, but in a way, at some point, they also just need to do the work. So if the talking to others at some point nearly substitutes your chess work, then it's a problem and not a help. So you really need to see, like, okay, talking to others should help me in a way to enjoy more and to do more work if you want to improve, right? So you need to be mindful about that once again. And just wanted to add one story why I wrote this newsletter was that Alessia and I, we don't like to do our cardio workout. And at some point, we were doing our warm up, and she clicked on the screen of this cardio. It was some bike or something like that. So she clicks on apps, and she sees there is a solitaire, this game where you have to like sort by cards, and I don't know how. I think most people know what I talk of. And Alessia starts doing that, and she starts, you know, running for like 15, 20, 25 minutes, and she nearly can't stop herself. And now we actually love to run. And recently I've been going to the gym, and instead of doing a warm up of 10 minutes, I did 55 minute or 50 minute run just because I just kept, you know, playing this game. And in a way, that's just one of the possible ways of doing what you don't want to do is somehow finding a way that you're nearly addicted to it and you just really like it, and it becomes more of a game. I have to say that's not as easy with chess, because you can't, for example, say, okay, I'll watch a film next to it. That's nice with running or whatever. But what you can do is you can put it on top or put it later. So you can say, like, I work half an hour on chess, and then I can watch half an hour of my favorite Netflix show, for example. And then you connect that feeling of relaxing and watching Netflix to solving hard exercises. You could even say, for every exercise I solve right, I get 5 minutes of whatever I enjoy, right? And then at some point, the fun part is, at some point, you can just take away the Netflix if you want, because you've created this trigger in your brain that solving an exercise right is cool because of the other thing, but now it's cool. And so you can first have this like low quality activity at the end. And then at some point, if you want, you can shorten it or you can stop it altogether, and it should work. And you keep doing what you want to do, and you feel it's more fun, even though there is no, you know, nothing after it anymore.
Yeah, yeah. That's all great suggestions. I love it. There was one other, I mean, you had several more categories and ways, or I should say several more strategies of inserting fun into the learning process for chess. There's just one other of those that I wanted to kind of hit on because I liked it so much. And that was basically just learning new things along with it, or within chess, I should say. That's a great concept. It's one I'm somewhat familiar with as well, but outside of a chess context. Noel, I think, and we'll get to this later because we're both very much into personal development, but I am aware of that idea of a kind of like novelty, adding newness to an experience to make it more enjoyable. But I hadn't heard anyone talk about it for chess until you. And for whatever reason, I hadn't thought about it from a chess perspective either. But yeah, I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that for people who hadn't read that newsletter in regards to like, how do we use new to make learning more enjoyable?
Yeah, so you can think of it like, you can say either the chess content has to be new, but that becomes hard at some point, right? Because every day something new, well, at some point it's, you know, the thing that works in chess is really, you know, improving your skills at some point and stop to plunder pieces and so on. So that won't be so new at some point. So what you can do is sometimes have something new in chess. You read about a structure you have never learned, or you read about a player you've never heard. But you can also make your training new. So in gym, that would be you go to the same gym, but every time you go there, you can try out to do something new, right? You can make different machines or put different things that you try to implement in your workout. So it's not every time the exact same thing. In chess, for example, what you can do is you can, instead of just going from A to Z, especially in like puzzle books, you can just open page 50 and just randomly solve one of those puzzles, which is already a little bit breaking the rhythm of, oh, I'll just open the same page again and go da, 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 da. So you just try to jump around in that a little bit. It gives you some novelty. Or you can, for example, you can do with friends. You can say, hey, every week I send you one page of exercises that I've curated for you. I've found, or I've had from my own games or whatever, that it's not that hard to, you know, when you have your eyes open and you study a lot of chess, there are a lot of interesting positions that you can give to your friends. And that's something new, because you're not knowing what will actually, you know, what will I solve on Tuesday? So there are some ways to, you know, implement novelty into your chess training schedule that can help you enjoy it more.
I really like those ideas a lot. I thought I'd take an opportunity to present one approach that I've tried in this realm of adding fun to the process and get your opinion on it. I'm a little nervous actually to ask you this because it runs up against a little bit, I think, of what a specific strategy we talked about in the last one, which was like dividing up your main buckets of learning into threes, one third of your time on openings, one third of your time on tactics, that kind of thing. So dividing, you know, the big buckets of what you're trying to improve at or study into thirds. And that gives you kind of a specific percentage of like how much time to spend on each, that sort of thing. And my idea runs up a little bit against that, but I wanted to get your take anyway, because it's something that I found helpful for me, but it would be interesting to hear, you know, someone at your level and your coaching experience give your feedback on it. So what I've done, I think like a lot of adult improvers, and they've been doing chess for a while and trying to get better, is that they realize what improvement activities they enjoy more than others. And, you know, I'm no exception to that. And so what I've done a little bit is to give myself a bit more time to the things that I enjoy, even knowing though that it both helps and it hurts. Like it hurts because it's not an optimal percentage time, maybe a little bit more time on openings, for example, than is ideal. But at the same time, I feel like it benefits me because it keeps me doing it. It keeps me from being bored or feeling like I just must do the work every time, no matter how I feel. So I kind of play with the ratios of time a little bit, making them a little less optimal, but a little bit more enjoyable for the process overall. I just want to get your take on that. I know it kind of runs up against your strategy, so I'm a little nervous, but that's what I've done.
So the idea you've talked about was the one third rule, which is like one third tactics, one third playing and analyzing, and then the last third it should be either openings, end games, or middle game, depending on your weaknesses, on where you are in your chess. So that's like a rough framework for everyone to understand, okay, what should I work on if I want to improve my chess? Then to your question, I think the simplest solution for that is just whatever you do more, or whatever you know that isn't, you know, bringing a lot of improvement, that you just count it as fun. And
interesting.
So I like to work with training plans, right? And I wouldn't put into my training plan, for example, watching YouTube video, or I wouldn't put into my training plan playing through games of Fischer, even if you could say, yeah, that helps a little bit. But I would say the general idea is more of I want to have fun and I want to see some chess history and not I want to improve, right? So you just split your things of like, oh, yeah, this is for fun and this is for improvement. And again, you can play with it and say, okay, for every hour I do, my training plan, I give myself half an hour, 1 hour, 2 hours, whatever. You have to decide how important improvement is of just full enjoyment. What I don't like or what I feel leads to a lot of frustration is when you're always in the middle. You don't really want to do the hard stuff, but you would like to improve. So you choose like some things, like for example, annotated games is one of those things that people think, yeah, I'm really improving, but you're not really improving that much. You're really, just getting some knowledge, getting some stories, but you're not really working hard on your chess. And what happens is you think I work 20, 30 hours every week on my chess, but I don't improve. And in reality, you're not really working on your chess, but you have the feeling that you do. And then this creates the frustration. So I think it's very important you just say, okay, this is time I just enjoy and I don't expect to get better at all. And then there's the time that I put in my time and I try to. My first idea is how do I get better in this time, right? And the other time, my first idea is how do I enjoy chess? And so you split those up, as I mentioned in the beginning, and then that can create more simplicity. And everybody should find their own, amount of how much fun and how much training there should be. For example, something I enjoy is poker. I've gotten into poker and I like to study poker. And I like to watch poker. But when I sit on my sofa and maybe Alessia's next to me as well, and we are watching, my favorite streamer for poker, I don't feel like I'm improving and I don't expect it. And the next time I play, I don't think I'll make better decisions because of that. So it's very clear in my mind. So for example, for the past 3 months, I've said, okay, I don't actually play much and I don't study. So I'm not frustrated if I take bad decisions because I haven't worked on my poker. So how should I make better decisions, right? So for me, these things are very clear. And I realize that for many people, they mix this up a little bit. Expectation is to get better, but there is not really the wish or the intensity of really training. And then you get frustrated.
Yeah, I appreciate the insight into the importance of distinguishing between what you're trying to do. So I wanted to now move on to kind of some topics that are related to your upcoming course, as well as talk about your upcoming course. Let's dive into that. Let me let people know, first of all, that you are, at the time of this recording, about to release a course for beginners. When this episode is actually released, that course will be out, and we'll have links to that in the show notes. And Noelle, you said that when you were creating your new course, that you discovered some basics you had never learned before, even as a GM, which is a really fascinating concept. What are one or two examples of those basic concepts that you learned?
So one very basic idea is that I've never realized that the rook staying on an empty board controls the same amount of squares on every square on the board. You can try that out at home if you don't believe me, but it's 14 on every single square. So wherever you put a rook on an empty square, empty board, it controls 14 squares. And I found that like interesting just as a, because I started with understanding the pieces. So I give like a lot of insights on what does this piece do? Where do you use that piece? On open diagonals, closed positions, all these kind of things. And I started with the piece on the empty board. And I was like, wait a moment. For the rook, nothing changes. For every other piece, well, the king has many squares where it controls also the same amount of squares. But other than that, like the knight, for example, there is a huge difference if it's in the corner or if it's in the center. But the rook controls always the same amount of squares. So that was one that got me interested.
Yeah, is there like a translation into that, into how we should understand the game? Like, what does that mean in terms of, practically speaking, probably more applicable in an endgame, but yeah.
Yeah, practically speaking, I think that just shows that you don't have to develop the rook that early, and that the rook just standing on an open file is doing an amazing job, and you don't really need to, you know, bring it closer, at least for a long time, right? So one of the beginner mistakes is playing h4 and then rook h3, for example, and people trying to activate the rook, but actually it's not really activated, and it will always be vulnerable. And if you just manage to bring it on an open file, it actually controls way more squares maybe than if it's somewhere on b4, you know, but it's not really having that huge scope and is vulnerable as well. So that's like the one insight you can take from that rook idea. So really, the rook is always usually the last piece to get developed, and it's happy to just be connected to the other rook and somewhere on an open or semi-open file on the first rank. That's it. You don't need to overdo it. While, for example, the knight, because on your last rank, the knight is controlling only three squares on the initial square. You want to get the knight into the game because best case scenario is you control eight squares. So you more than doubled the knight's power just with one move maybe. And that's why the knight also moves very early in the game, right? So these are like some kind of ideas of, once you understand the really basics, it's easier to understand things like, oh, develop your knight to f3. Well, the idea behind that is not that on f3 the knight is always standing better. It's just that on f3 it's controlling 8 squares and on e2 it's controlling 6 only. So that shows you, oh, that's actually why I want to develop my knight on f3. So like, I try to really dig deep and find the super fundamentals that carry these kind of general knowledge that many people know, but they don't know why it is the case.
Right, right. I think you had one more other concept that had eluded you even in your own chess journey up to this point.
Yeah, so just one fun fact, and then one more I think that is very useful for people. So one fun fact is that when I studied tactics, I understood, wait, a fork is actually a double attack with one piece. I have never linked it. I have always obviously known what the fork is and what a double attack is. It's like there is no double attack with one piece, at least not that I know of, that isn't a fork. So that's like an interesting thing. Like, so if you double attack with one piece, then you make a fork. While double attacking with two pieces are then other definitions. So that's just one fun fact I had to smile at. And then an idea, so in endgames, right? So in the course, I wanted to help people promote a pawn to a queen. And I, you know, went through some of the important positions, and then I came up with some rules that I think are very, very useful. So if you think about a pawn endgame, you have one pawn and your opponent doesn't have a pawn anymore. And their king is close to where your pawn has to queen, right? So that's when it really makes a difference. Where is your king standing? So if your king is standing two squares in front of your pawn, somewhere on the file where your pawn is, or one to the side, you will always win the game. It's a theoretical win, no matter where the opponent king stays. If your king is one square ahead of the pawn, so let's say pawn is on e2 and king is on f3, e3, or d3, then it matters if you are in the opposition or not. If you're in the opposition, you will manage to go two squares in front, and so that's why this position is winning. If the opponent is in the opposition, you will be forced to at some point put the pawn next to your king. And then we get to rule number three, whenever king and pawn are next to each other and you can't force to bring your king up, you will be drawing the game. So that's like a simple idea to think about, like, okay, if my king is two squares in front of pawn, that's always a win. It has to win somehow. And the idea is that because you can just move the pawn one forward, you can force the opposition and then you can move again with the king forward. So that's just something that you can use as a rule, just as a square rule, right? Many people know the square rule when the pawn can just promote alone. You can use that rule, king two squares ahead, or two ranks, I should probably say, right? Two ranks in front of the pawn. Okay, that's winning.
Right. Yeah, those are the other great rules to remember. In preparing for our discussion, you mentioned to me that beginners today are much different than they were 15 years ago. And I think this is a fascinating concept and one that's worth diving into, regardless of whether you're a beginner or not. So let's just start with elaborating on that. How are beginners different today than they were 15 years ago?
So 15 years ago, the chess world, maybe I started 20 years ago, but 15 years ago, it was still the same. Many people were just playing in the clubs, right? Many people were learning chess from their parents or in schools or in the club. Like, there wasn't so much online chess, and there were no Queen's Gambit and all these things. So what happened is somebody referred to as a beginner was somebody rated, let's say, 1400 feet even. So when you start playing chess, when you started playing chess in Switzerland, I think my first initial rating, they gave you 1450. So 1450 points, just basically as an initial rating, and then you would go up or down from that, right? So that's a huge difference to what is happening online right now. I don't even know what is the initial rating, but like, there's a vast majority of players online that are below 1000, right? And back then you just started with 1450. So the word beginner in chess, for chess books and just in general, was used mostly to refer to players around 1400. While now, that creates confusion, because people that are starting and really having a rating of 500 and they are the true beginners, they get beginner books or beginner labeled books and they don't get it. They are like, wait, why is there some missing information? Why am I not getting it? So a lot of the things that were written for beginners, there is like books like beginner pattern recognition, beginner this, beginner that, they aren't really for real beginners. And that's why many beginners are confused and don't find the right resources, because just the definition of beginner has basically changed, or where a beginner is standing has changed, because 15 years back or 10 years back, even, you first played a little bit with friends, you learned the rules, you did this, you did, and then you went to a club and then you bought a book. And now you just play a little bit online and you search for a course or a book, and then you're at a different point in your chess career.
Hmm. Okay, yeah, so this is a really interesting subject, and there's a few questions I have for you based on what you said. So one problem you identified is clearly that resources were labeled differently back then, 15 years, and I assume, you know, anything before then as well, in terms of what a beginner resource was. Is there also a difference, do you feel at all, in terms of the actual skill level of what we would call a beginner today versus then? Or is it just, we are defining them differently in the past then than we are now? Or, well, I guess it's very related questions, I guess, and there's overlap in what I'm talking about. But I guess I kind of want to get to the skill portion of it. Is there any substantive difference between someone who's been playing chess for, say, just 3 to 6 months right now than there was someone playing chess 3 to 6 months 15 years ago?
No, I don't think that the, you know, just... There is a general saying that you can say, like, okay, somebody that played for three months and did XYZ is now less strong than back then. I think it's just more that beginner was more referred to like the person that begins to play in a club, while now beginner is the person that learns chess, right? So that's a difference, yeah. Right? Because many people also that I teach or that get courses, read my stuff, they are saying, I want to get on a level where I feel like I can join a club, right? So, and then they need something different than the person that has just joined the club, felt good about it, and now wants a course. So these are just different levels. It's I've seen online sometimes, it was mentioned there is for novice, and novice I think was before beginners. But it's like, if you use the word beginner, to me it's like beginning something. Well, let's start with the rules, right? Because I can't just say, hey, here is beginner, I don't know, For example, mm-hmm. beginner calculation is something very absurd to me, because calculation is something that happens at a higher level. There is no beginner calculation. There is beginner don't hang your piece, right? But calculation is something deeper, something, you know, you do, you take a lot of time, you try to, you have different lines, you have deeper lines. So the beginner calculation doesn't make sense. There is no beginner calculation, in my opinion. Yeah.
Right, right. Okay, yeah. So now so as a result of this difference, we have like a resource confusion problem. Is that the main consequence of it?
I do definitely think so. Yeah, there is a lot of things that, or a lot of people that think they are the problem, but instead they are just consuming courses, books, you know, videos that just don't, you know, don't even cater to their audience. And that's actually where, for example, YouTube has developed way quicker than the courses and books, right? Because there are YouTubers like Gotham who have understood, like, where is a beginner actually? What is actually a beginner? And has catered sometimes to that audience. Whereas for books and for courses, there aren't really that many that really fit the beginner. And just as a general idea, no matter where you are, if a course is chess specific, so there will be moves and positions that are explained, right? And there is a huge, you know, amount of people, let's say from 1,000 to 2,000, usually the ones that are the lowest will be a little bit overwhelmed, and the ones that are the highest should be a little bit bored. So I prefer, for example, this course, right, is beginner chess mastery. So I just want to talk to people that are below 1200 or around 1200 online, chess.com as an idea. If I would do the same concepts and say, hey, let's do up to 1800, then some people won't understand and other people will feel, well, this is so boring, right? So the bigger the spectrum of people is, if there is a chess specific thing, the harder it is to provide for everyone what they really need.
So do you have any advice on how beginners in particular can navigate this world we live in, where some things are appropriately labeled for them and other things perhaps are not, particularly given this new definition of beginners? And I think most beginners probably define themselves that way now, right, as the lower rating version of that. What advice would you give them in terms of how to figure out what resources are appropriate for them?
So I would say just really focus on the basics, and also look at what this resource wants to cater to, right? As we mentioned, if it should be for beginners, but also intermediate and also club players, you should get a little bit, you know, skeptical, because that will be hard for somebody to use the same language to a beginner and a club player for the same position. Right. So even, for example, opening courses are a great example. If you have an opening and you want to explain that to a beginner, you not only use other words, but you might have to recommend different lines, because a beginner isn't ready to understand certain ideas and you don't want to overwhelm them. So you use a very simplified version. And then once they get stronger, they start to realize, oh, there is actually this exception, and here it might be okay to leave my king in the center. But if you just say, oh, here there is this exception and this and that, and because of these three moves, and they will just get lost. So yeah, I would just say most important thing is find things that are specifically catered to beginners. And maybe if it's a book, you should be more, or even sometimes courses, you should be very, very careful and see what kind of people they have in their courses or what they cater to as for their book.
Yeah, great advice. Something just occurred to me as you were talking about this, particularly with openings. You mentioned earlier, Noel, that the idea of beginner calculation is is something of an oxymoron. It doesn't really work that way. I'm also wondering, would you go so far as to say that could be true for openings as well, in terms of if you said opening course for beginners and it's about a specific opening, that, you know, if you're really 1,000 or under, should you be studying all these lines in an opening book? Probably is premature. So I'm wondering if you would even say that maybe the idea of something labeled a beginner openings is a bit of a stretch as well.
So what I've tried to do with the course, I thought about this for a long time because I don't really like opening courses, but many people think that their problem is opening, right? So they will still inevitably start to buy some opening courses, and usually they are way too big. So what I've done with the course is inside the main part of the course, people will learn the beginner opening principles, the guiding principles, just helping you understand opening moves in general. How do you, you know, develop your pieces, getting your king into safety, controlling the center, and how to apply those. And then as a bonus, I have actually a beginner opening repertoire. Now, repertoire is a big word. Maybe we could say that is a little bit beginner repertoire. Doesn't really fit, but the idea is basically giving them a setup for the most common openings played on beginner level and just understanding the more precise plans and ideas of where do you put your pieces and how do you fend off against some silly tricks and traps. That's basically it. So in, I think around, it's maybe a little bit less or around 4 hours, I've provided a full white and black repertoire. So other opening courses, they are like 40 hours, right? For one single opening. And I've taken 4 hours and I give everything you really absolutely want to know. But it's still a bonus. So I agree with you in the sense of you don't really need to have this move-by-move stuff if you want to reach 1200 online. It's enough to have the opening principles. Just, you know, to start with E4 with white, put your pieces out, know what is the perfect setup, and get your king into safety, stop plundering pieces, and that's enough. But if you want to, or if you think that openings is your problem, or you want to have like a clear idea, some people just are nervous when they don't know what should I play. I heard of all these things, the Sicilian and the Scandi and this gambit and that gambit. So they know what to do against those. They can use that bonus. But I think it should be completely different than a normal course, a normal openings course, right? So there is really a big difference between a standard opening course or even a lifetime repertoire. You can hunt like lifetime opening repertoires for beginners. That's like, what's that? Like, right. That just doesn't make sense, right? The idea, basically, if you don't have to adjust your openings, even if you get stronger, then you learn way too much and you get overwhelmed and you learn stuff you don't understand. Period. There is no way that you learn a lifetime opening repertoire that works if you proceed 300 points and you didn't just waste so much time because you've learned way too much. So I think that's very important to understand, the idea of I never have to study openings again and doing what is best for your level. They don't work together.
Yeah. Yeah, that's all great points. Yeah, so it sounds like you're saying that there's a version of studying openings for beginners that, even if we were talking a little bit of lines here, that can make sense if it's kind of the way you approach it, small and concrete and, you know, very practical. And there's another version of opening study or opening courses for beginners that make absolutely no sense. Is that a fair characterization?
That is a fair point, I would say. Yes, and actually, like, a lot of people that get the course, they will realize, like, sometimes I just say, and here there is no danger anymore. This is where you put your pieces. Now go play, right? Like, it's not like, okay, and here, you know, play for this small weakness and there is this cool trick and there is that. And no, whatever. Like, just if you get better than your opponents, especially on beginner level, like, I would even say up to 1500, like, your opponents always give you ideas. They always give you chances. So you don't need, you know, this like sophisticated opening to get a chance. That's what happens on GM level because people are so strong. You need to force them to make mistakes because as long as your opponents just offer you stuff, you don't need to be sophisticated. You just need to take the stuff and stop offering yourself.
Noel, I wanted to talk about a little bit of a bird's eye view here perspective on you creating this course because it is fascinating to me. Now, I'm by no means an expert on all the different authors who've created beginner resources. And when I say beginner, I'm talking now about like the modern definition that you know that you're using for your course and things like that. But it strikes me that there's probably not a lot of grandmasters who created beginner level material. So that part fascinates me. So as a grandmaster, what motivated you to create a chess beginner's course?
So basically I have this next level training course, right? Where I have recommended resources. I teach people how to study. And I realized more and more players below 1200 online are joining this course. And so I wanted to provide good recommended resources that people enjoy and help people improve their chess, because I'm basically providing the principles of how to study, and then people can go out and get great courses, great books, use free resources to get better at chess. And what I started to realize is that people said that some things I recommended were too high, so they didn't completely understand, right? There is the grandmaster that started a long time ago thinking what is beginner and not understanding what it actually is. And then I started, you know, reading books and studying courses, and I just didn't find the resource that I thought, okay, I'm really happy to recommend that. And I do have these kind of resources. I do have them for all other levels, basically. So there are amazing books that I have studied myself. I'm not saying that they are, you know, nothing is good, but it just, there wasn't anything that I was like, yeah, I'm very happy to recommend that in my course. And the people that I recommended to say, yeah, that's great. So there was like a hole. And after some research, I just decided, okay, if I don't find it, I gotta do it myself. And that's how I started working on that course.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm curious about that a little bit. So was there like one or two things that you felt was consistently missing from these other beginner resources, and therefore you kind of wanted to fill in that particular gap? Or was it maybe just a lack of something being comprehensive, where like, you know, resources were good, but they only gave you a piece or part of what you needed to learn at that stage? Yeah, I'm just kind of curious what you felt your resource that you're creating here does that maybe others didn't do.
Yeah, it was a bit a combination of the two. So it was that I prefer something all in one, especially for beginners, because I feel if somebody starts playing, right, and they start to want their first book or their first course, they shouldn't need to buy seven different things. So they shouldn't need to buy beginner opening course and then beginner, you know, opening principles and then beginner strategy. And then, and that right. also costs a lot at some point, right? So that was yeah. one problem. And there are some all-in-one courses and books. But with those, I've felt that there wasn't enough. I love to dive deep, right? As we talked about the single piece, and just give really the why, not just say like, opening principle is developing your pieces, but why do you even develop pieces? Like why should you play with all your pieces, right? Just like these kind of ideas, and starting from nothing, starting from the bare piece, just standing on the board, all the way to having this whole holistic idea of chess, even how to think in chess is inside the course, right? So what should your brain actually produce when you look at the chessboard? What questions do you ask yourself? So there wasn't anything that fulfilled all of these things. I just want to mention one thing, that actually the thing or the book I liked most was Bruce Pandolfini's Ultimate Guide to Chess, which is somewhat funny because it's a quite old book, right? So that's it's nearly as if then the beginner was really still the beginner. and yeah, I've enjoyed that a lot. And something that I recommend in general is the step method, those books. But the step method books, they don't have as much explanations, right? They are very dry. And I felt like, okay, there you can add something to that.
I love your explanations on how your resource is going to be different. And I'm also happy to hear, though, that Bruce Pandolfini's book was perhaps the best one that you found up to this point. I have a fondness for him personally because his books were the books that I was reading when I was learning to get better at chess for the first time in my life back when I was an adolescent around 12 years old. So I'm happy to hear that his resources still kind of, you know, at least more or less get a seal of approval from you. Let's see. So I wanted to ask you this, Noel, just kind of like on a personal level. I know this isn't really related to, maybe it is, I don't know, directly the study of chess. But, you know, I can't help but wonder what it feels like as a grandmaster who has such a, at least, you know, from a club player's perspective, such a deep knowledge of the game to explain, you know, at length, these very basic concepts, the most basic concepts, because we're talking about beginners. As you were creating all this material for your course, was covering those concepts like just remarkably simple and obvious to you? Or did you at least find it perhaps challenging and stimulating from the perspective of, you know, communicating clearly, organizing clearly?
Now, I know that this might sound, you know, he wants to sell his course, so he'll say that he enjoyed it, whatever. But I really think that when you are a master of a craft, really the last level is being able to explain things in a simple way, right? So you understand extremely deep concepts, but what is so interesting is once you start to be able to simplify stuff and be able to explain it to people. So I found that actually very interesting in doing that course, and that's why also why I try to really dive deeply of like, if I know a concept, like, why is it even the case? Like, how can I make it clear, or how can I compare it to another sport, right? Just, for example, why should you trade off pieces when you're winning? And you can say, look at it. If you play soccer or football for Europe, and your opponents have a red card, so they have one player less, would you prefer playing 1 against 0 or 11 against 10? And obviously you'd prefer playing 1 against 0 because you just always score without a problem, while 11 against 10 isn't yet that, you know, that big of a difference. And in chess, if you're, for example, even a rook up, it might not be as obvious how to win the position being a rook up, but once you start trading down pieces and you just have a rook and some pawns and your opponent has only pawns, you just go to take all the pawns for free and it's really, really straightforward. And that is why you should trade off pieces, right? So I tried really to go to the why all the time. And with the people that have tested the course, they seem to have worked very well, where things that maybe they have heard already really clicked and made sense. And this way, I hope for people, it's easier to, you know, understand the game of chess. And I think I've also learned some stuff myself of really like, how do I break down things, knowledge I have and I had for many, many years, how do I break them down in simple words?
So yeah, Noel, I know we talked a good amount about your course already, just kind of touched on things a little bit here and there. So we have talked about it, but I think it would be good to just give people like a little overview of what it would include and, you know, precisely who it's for. So if you just wanted to just take a moment to kind of discuss some of its key benefits.
Yeah, so the premise of the course is that it features everything you need to know to be able to reach a level of 1,200 online chess.com rating, rapid rating, as a rough guy. That's like 1,400, 1,450 on LeeChess. So it's for everyone that are below that level, or for people that are around that level and feel like they don't have the fundamentals. And how the course is built up is there is actually a rule section. So if you have never played, if you don't know, it's probably not that likely that you would listen to a chess podcast. But let's say you have a friend or a family member that would love to get into chess. That course can help them to start with the rules and then start understanding the game. And then after the rules, which obviously everyone that knows the rules already can skip, you'll get three different parts. So part number one will be how to get a good position, where we talk about how to use your pieces. You'll understand the opening principles. You'll understand strategy. You'll understand how to come up with a plan, which side to play on, like these general ideas of getting a good position. Part number two is using that good position and transferring it into material advantage or a checkmate. So that will be tactics, that will be hanging pieces, that will be checkmate patterns in the middle game. And then part number three is once you're up pieces, how do you actually win the game? Which will be this idea of how to trade down, how to be able to use just one single pawn to promote it, how to checkmate the bear king. And this is like the main course. And then you have a bonus section, which you just can feel free to check it out, where there will be the white and black repertoire. There will be analyzing your game. So I will show you how you should, as a beginner, analyze your games and learn from them. And there is a little mindset section as well, where you just, you know, get a refreshment of how, what mindset do you need to use to get better at chess without getting frustrated.
That's fantastic. I love it. And for people listening, there is a link to all the details on the course in the show notes to this episode, as well as the page on my website that covers this episode. So you can check that out there if you want even more information about it and or you are interested in getting it. And Noel is a fantastic teacher and coach, so I definitely recommend it. I've had a chance to look through it myself, and it's really good. It's even nice kind of getting a little refresher on some basic things. Kind of like you said, Noel, you know, even as a grandmaster, there's some things that you still pick up and can get insights on, all the more true for me as a club player when looking through your course. So yeah, it's really, really good stuff. I just kind of wanted to finish on our interview, Noel, on the subject a little bit of chess and personal development, for two reasons. One is we've already done my standard section on fun questions in our last interview, so we've already done that. But also because I share that interest with you in personal development, as I think I mentioned earlier in the interview. So finding that intersection between the two, I think, is a really interesting topic, and I hope other people might find it interesting as well. So I guess my basic question about it is, are there any books that you've read in it that you think would be helpful for someone's chess improvement journey specifically?
So that's always a dangerous question to ask me, because I'll start recommending 50 books, but I'll try to just keep it at one.
Which sure, is, one or two.
Recently, I've Aidan Rayner, another chess creator, very deep into self-development as well, has recommended me Dopamine Nation by Dr. Very nice doctor. don't know the name, but if you search Dopamine Nation, you'll find it. It is a fantastic book, understanding not only how you get addicted, but also how you can, you know, get yourself to do things that are hard and maybe not giving as much dopamine, and you know, refrain from sometimes getting too much dopamine or just getting addicted to these dopamine hits, like just scrolling social media and just getting, yeah, these high dopamine but low quality activities. So that's again an amazing book, and I really strive to implement a lot of that into my own life.
That's great. Yeah, definitely sounds interesting. What's the overlap there on that book and the chess improvement journey, would you say?
Well, I think we've talked about, right, what is fun usually, or what is just intrinsically fun, the most fun, is usually not what brings you ahead in life. So your life is a lot about, like, I think Naval Ravikant said once, like, self-improvement is choosing the long term over the short term, or something like that. And I like that quite a lot. So a lot of chess improvement is as well just choosing the long term, what helps your game, but isn't as fun in the moment. Maybe you can make it more fun, but it's intrinsically, it's less fun than what you can just, you know, scroll the YouTube shorts or whatever you can, sure, you can do. So that's a big point of, like, getting yourself to do the things you know are good for you. And the fun thing also, for example, with the gym is after doing the gym, I feel amazing. After, you know, just lying on my couch for 2 hours and watching Netflix, I usually feel shit. So actually, right. It makes you feel better, but not instantly. So we need to overcome this moment. And that, I think, dopamination gives you some great tips on that.
That's fantastic. Well, that's a perfect place to end it, I think, our conversation, Noel. And I like that recommendation. I like the insights that you had for that on that book and why it can be helpful. Yeah, and I just want to say thank you so much for being on this show. I always enjoy talking to you. You have fantastic wisdom, insights, knowledge to share because I know you spend not only a lot of time, you have spent not only a lot of time on mastering the craft of playing chess, but also, you know, just how to communicate and discuss getting better, ideas for getting better at it, what helps, what doesn't. And so I always appreciate those insights that you bring to the show, and I'm really grateful for them. And the last thing I want to say is I encourage people to check out your course. If you're a beginner for that one, obviously you have another course if people are past that, which we'll have a link to as well. Yeah, so I just want to say thank you again, Noel, for being on the show.
Yeah, that was a pleasure. And just for everyone, you can also join the newsletter that Daniel was referencing. And this one is completely free. So that's just a very simple way of getting some more chess advice, but for free.
Yeah, I highly recommend reading that. Obviously, I like it a lot. Otherwise, I wouldn't spend 15, 20 minutes discussing just one of those newsletters with you on this show. But I do think that's a reflection of how helpful your content is there. So thank you, Noel, and I really appreciate you being on the show.
I appreciate you as well. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This has been a production of my business, Adult Chess Academy. And that has a website with the same name if you want to look for it. You can also find me being way too active on Twitter by searching my username, Lona_chess. See you next week.